Good morning.
Good morning to the court and good morning to counsel. May it please the court, Arthur Jarris on behalf of the plaintiff's appellants, the entire group. As the court is aware, the plaintiff appellants appeal from the grant of summary judgment by the district court to the defendants on all three counts of our complaint under ERISA. We also appeal the denial of our own plaintiff's motion for summary judgment on count two. Plainly, count one is the count of principal significance, Your Honors. Count one charges the defendants with unlawfully cutting back an in-service benefit conferred upon the plaintiffs by amendment, what we call amendment number one, which was adopted on January 28, 2008.
But doesn't that require us to understand really what amendment number one did? Because as I understand it, the district court saw amendment number one as part and parcel of the termination process, or if you will, conferring a benefit only if termination was completed, and the district court deferred to the interpretation of the administrators of the plan, which was, the way I like to think of it is, termination was a process. It wasn't a moment, and since there was never any distribution, the process wasn't complete, and the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation said, okay, you didn't terminate, and so Amendment 1 never came into effect to confer a benefit.
I would not agree.
There was never any benefit. There was never any cutback.
Well, I agree. It's critical that we have to understand what Amendment 1 did. But the court did not defer to any determination by the plan administrator or the committee as to whether or not there had ever been a termination, because at the time the committee finally and belatedly acted, amendment number two had already been adopted.
Well, but see, I maybe I'm not making myself clear. I think what this reveals is that the pension committee, and this is a plan that confers discretion on the committee to interpret the terms of the plan, whether you want to say just at Amendment 1 or by the time you take 1 and 2 together, its interpretation of the concept of termination in the plan is one which requires distribution of benefits before termination has finally occurred. There are steps along the way to termination, and actually the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation's brief lists quite a few of them. But I guess the premise is that the word termination itself is a word that needs interpretation, and the committee interpreted it in a certain way.
I don't see any finding that the committee interpreted that word in a certain way, although the court, I think, assumed that to be the case.
Well, so isn't that good enough?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe so, because the committee cannot act in the interest of the employer, because the committee is formulated by the employer, and not properly interpret, not even reasonably interpret, the words of the plan or the related pension trust. And I refer the court to page 7 of the appellant's brief, where we quote the key provisions of the plan, and at page 8, the key provisions of the related pension trust. 11.4A of the plan specifically says, at the bottom of page 7 of appellant's brief, upon the revocation or termination in whole or in part of the plan for any reason, the trustee shall liquidate that portion of the assets of the plan allocable, etc. The plain language of the plan, which the defendants have never addressed, the pension committee never addressed, I don't believe the trial court ever addressed, the plain language is that termination has to happen and then the trustee shall liquidate the assets of the plan.
Argued that, but I'm just going to point out to you that on page 9 of the district court's opinion, the court says the pension committee's interpretation of the plan is entitled to deferential review, and then if you move over to page 12 of the district court's opinion, under subheading A, the district court says the pension committee, this is right at the bottom of the page, the pension committee interpreted the language of Amendment 1 to mean that the plaintiff's claimed entitlement was conditioned on the plan's actual termination and distribution of assets. So Whether you think that's a correct interpretation or not, we can discuss. But it looks to me like the district court knew that there was deference due to the committee, and the district court expressly says this is how the committee interpreted the termination proceedings.
Well, I only see an oblique reference that I do not believe stands for that proposition, Your Honor.
I read it. I mean, I guess
I agree the court properly, correctly read the district court's opinion, but I question the accuracy of the opinion in stating what the pension committee interpreted it. I don't know that that's a fair statement. I don't know that that can be backed up to the record itself as to what the pension committee actually did.
So what the pension committee thought, let's just get away from words like interpretation, but what the pension committee clearly thought was that until distribution of the assets occurred, it was still free to back away from the termination, because that's what it did. It was advised by everybody, the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, the Internal Revenue Service, its lawyers, you know, everyone said, yeah, that's right. Until distribution has occurred, you can still back away. I realize your legal position is there comes some moment when termination has happened, and then the only way to unwind it is through 1347, which, of course, has only happened once in the LTV case. That, I don't think anybody says, happened here. But that strikes me as the pivotal question in this case.
I agree that the pivotal question is whether the plan, not the trust, because the trust holds the assets. The pension trust clearly had never termed.
Authority for drawing such a sharp distinction between the plan and the trust that holds assets.
Well, the legal authority is twofold, Your Honor. They are separate documents. The plan is created by.
I've never seen this in ERISA law. Plans have assets. I mean, maybe that's a shorthand. Some plans are administered by insurance companies. Some plans are insured, or self.
But who is the owner of the assets? Who holds legal title to the assets? The trustees of the pension trust actually hold the assets, and they administer those assets in accordance with directions from the authority designated by the plan, which would be the administrator. The administrator gives the trustee directions.
But they're required to do what the administrator of the plan says. So this actually is a very nice plan. This is a defined benefit plan. There aren't too many of those out there anymore. And when people reach retirement age, they actually get a defined benefit.
Correct. My point is this, Your Honor. When we look at both the plan document.
From the trust assets, I would say.
I didn't understand that, Your Honor.
When the defined benefit is paid, the source of money is the trust.
Yes, that's correct.
So it's all interlinked.
But
it's not it's like trust over here and plan over there.
Well, I agree they're intertwined. But what I'm saying, Your Honor, is that both documents, the plan document and the trust agreement, both are consistent in saying that termination of the plan occurs first, and then the assets of the plan that are held in the trust get distributed.
But that's not how the plan interpreted it, though. The plan said termination may begin with an announcement by the plan, but until the assets have been distributed, it's not complete.
Yeah. If that, in fact, is what the pension committee ever determined, and it was not acting at the time of the dispute. The pension committee was sitting dormant through the process until after the lawsuit was commenced. Pension committee had not acted. Amendment number one, adding the in-service benefit, was added. Then we filed our claim.
That's a very sensible benefit if the whole thing is wrapping up, because if you're getting rid of your pension plan altogether, you don't need the trust holding assets. So, of course, you're going to distribute it to people. Separating it out and making this a benefit available to people who haven't retired yet yields tremendous tax problems. It yields problems of inconsistency with ERISA. It's a nightmare.
I did not understand what the court just said. There's no question but that amendment number one, which added the termination provisions, added the in-service benefit.
If there is a termination.
That is correct, Your Honor.
There wasn't a termination.
Well, that is what our briefs are dedicated to showing was in error by the district court, Your Honor. The plain language of the plan and the trust say that termination is not dependent on distribution of plan assets, and the statutory scheme does not require there to be a complete distribution or even a partial distribution of plan assets. And the syntax decision, which we cite to, says that once PBGC determines that such a date, meaning the proposed termination date, is in accord with the interests it is required by statute to protect, that date becomes the final termination date. And it further says, syntax, the Third Circuit, in a 1341 termination, it is assumed that the plan administrator will have the employer's interest in mind when it proposes a termination date. Once PBG accepts that proposed date, quote, syntax had no discretion to change its mind. So syntax is saying,
what if the assets aren't sufficient to terminate?
The employer must contribute additional assets.
Well, that's what they said they couldn't do. So they
no, they did not. Out. Your Honor, in this case, they did not say they could not do that. They did not want to do that. They never said that they could not do that. That's a different matter. We recognize in our brief that under the regulation, if it turned out that the employer lacked the financial ability to make up the funding shortfall, then the unwind, and only then is the unwind allowed to occur. That was not this case.
There were more factors involved here. Obviously, there was a merger and all these things that all had to be backed out of because of the incapacity, of being able to measure up to passing out money while people still worked.
There is absolutely nothing in the record to indicate incapacity. And since this occurs on summary judgment, we're entitled to the inference that we were not afforded by the district court, that the employer did have the means to fund any additional amount required. There was nothing in the record, Your Honor, that Finkel was unable to fund additional amounts required to complete distribution of assets on a full funding basis, including of the in-service benefit. This in-service benefit that was added was what we call an optional form of the benefit. It is protected by Title I, the labor law provisions of ERISA against cutback. What the company did when it realized it was going to have to put more money in is it changed its mind. It didn't want to have to do that, which is exactly what the Syntex case forbids. The district court went against Syntex and said, we're going to let the employer change its mind. The
district court distinguished Syntex is actually what it did. It didn't say I'm disagreeing. It said this is a different situation.
Well, I think it's very parallel to Syntex because what happened is that the only reason for the adoption of Amendment Number 2 is that the employer did not want to go through for financial reasons with the amendment that it had adopted that conferred the in-service benefit. So I agree with the court. The key issue here is whether the plan terminated. And again, there is no basis, there is no reasonable basis whatsoever for the plan and trust instrument to have been construed any other way but to...
I'll just point out that the court in its decision denying the motion to reconsider said that the Syntex court rested largely on the employer's failure to obtain the PBGC's consent for withdrawal in the case before this court. In contrast to Syntex, the PBGC was apprised of Finkel's intent to abort the termination process and explicitly endorsed Finkel's withdrawal. So the court doesn't just say, I don't like Syntex. The court finds a reason to distinguish it.
That is what Judge Pallmeyer stated. But the PBGC,
and it's the difference between the two.
But the PBGC's amicus brief filed in this case said, contrary to Judge Pallmeyer, PBGC did not make any such determination.
I think you're picking at hairs there. They said it wasn't an agency action that would have triggered rights of judicial review on your part, I believe is what they said.
We weren't not even notified that any action was going on, Your Honor.
Right, and so the PBGC is saying we're not criticizing you at all for not
But the regulation, Your Honor, the key regulation says that if the PBGC does not issue a notice within so many days of the application for approval to terminate under standard termination, then Syntex says that's the termination date, and the regulation says the assets then must be distributed and cannot be unwound apart from financial insufficiency, inability, which is not present here. And so what we have is the company trying to avoid its obligation, which it communicated to the participants for financial reasons, in violation of the regulations. And
so what's your argument about the tax problems with giving a distribution of pension fund monies to somebody who hasn't retired? Your brief seems to say, oh, well, what the heck, there's a little bit of extra tax to pay.
Well, first
and
of all,
pretty much unwinds the whole plan, doesn't it?
Well, actually, as we point out, the tax part of ERISA was amended. The tax code itself was amended to allow in-service distributions, even in this kind of defined benefit pension plan, to employees who had attained age 62. So there's, to the extent this court or the district court would uphold the in-service benefit against cutback for the plaintiffs when they attain age 62, there's absolutely no tax issue. Let's say that this court or on remand the lower court says, we're also going to give the plaintiffs the whole loaf of affirming and upholding the in-service benefit even for plaintiffs before age 62, then there is a tax qualification problem. Case law says we do not concern ourselves with tax qualification, but let me address that. If Finkel were concerned about losing tax-qualified status of the plan in that situation, all it has to do is complete the termination of the plan, because in-service benefits for terminating defined benefit plans do not cause loss of qualification. It's only in-service benefits for employees under age 62 of an ongoing plan that creates tax problems. So it's easy for them to solve. If the in-service benefit were to be, as we request, upheld and enforced under the anti-cutback rules, and if Finkel is concerned that their plan would lose tax-qualified status, all they have to do is complete the termination, which they should do anyway.
Well, they can't complete this termination. They'd have to institute a new one.
I don't know why that would be. Well, they're already under a duty to complete it.
Well, let's move to this whole fee thing, because I think you have real problems on this, because you get notice of you get notice of what's going to happen, and you file the benefit, 28 days after you get notice, I'm getting the time.
Your Honor, are we talking,
yeah,
which
I'm
count
talking
are we
about your fees, because
on count two?
On count two,
okay.
On the fees, 21 mm-hmm. days after you get notice, you file suit. The pension committee has 90 days to make some determination. I don't understand.
No, Your Honor,
how
that is not what happened. The claims were filed in the spring.
Well, didn't the claims administrator issue a written determination 28 days after receiving your benefit claim?
Absolutely.
And under the plan administrator has 90 days to respond to a benefit claim.
That's right.
But you filed suit. You filed suit 3 weeks after the demand letter was sent.
Your Honor, that is not correct. Here's the record is unmistakably clear on this. The claims were filed on May 19th, 2008. The committee, 90 days, Your Honor is correct. Under the SPD and the regulations, they have 90 days. The pension committee has 90 days to process those claims. They did not. They did not act on the claims.
But then there's another letter of November 24th, 2008, in
Counsel,
which you send a letter demanding that the claims be processed. You file suit on December 15th.
Yes, we asked the... Yes, Your Honor,
but they've told you 35 times in the meantime that they don't think they've terminated the plan.
No, they hadn't.
They send you a letter on May 23rd, that notify you they're not going to terminate. They pass Amendment 2. They send you another letter on June 18th saying the plan hasn't been terminated, no violation. So they're in communication with you.
But those were not actions processing the claims.
Well, they're, I don't know. Okay. You have just about used up all but 1 minute of your argument time.
All right.
You want to save a portion of a minute.
Thank you, Judge.
You're from Mr. McGillicott.
May it please the Court, I'm James McElligott with McGuire Woods. My co-counsel, Sarah Zielinski, is at counsel table. We represent the defendants and appellees. And I'd first like to respond to the Court's questions with respect to the Syntex case. In general, there's no question, I think, that the district court got it absolutely right, in our view, in a very thorough and comprehensive opinion. And the district court judge correctly distinguished Syntex. There's another reason that the court did not address, because it's a little difficult, I think, in just reading Syntex. The Syntex case clearly did not involve a standard termination. If you look at the style of the case, it's in re Syntex. Syntex had insufficient assets, and there was an unfunded liability with respect to that plan.
But was it a distress termination?
Exactly right, Your Honor. Precisely correct. And because of that, under the provisions of Title IV, because the PBGC would have liability with respect to that, the pension administrator requests a date. The PBGC approves it, and as the court knows, in terms of the provisions of Title IV, although the plan administrator can consider the employer's concerns, the PBGC's concerns with respect to that date have to do with what's in the best interests of the participants and the PBGC. Now, why is the date important? Well, as the PBGC knows, it's the date on which liabilities are assessed. It's the date on which assets are determined. So it is a very key issue with respect to determining what the PBGC's liability is going to be. It also determines what the liabilities will be in the case of so-called control group members who might share in that unfunded liability. So the Syntex case really has nothing to do with this issue, and it shouldn't. And the court shouldn't be surprised that the PBGC, in its amicus brief, which completely supported the lower court's decision with respect to the question of plan termination, PBGC didn't even mention Syntex because it was a non-issue. It's a distress termination case where the PBGC has a vital interest in the date of plan termination. So the Third Circuit correctly said that the employer can't change that date without the agreement of the PBGC. Now, what about this case? What position has the PBGC taken in our situation? Well, clearly the PBGC's view is there is no termination of this plan. No one has suggested that there is any basis for a distress termination.
But, you know, it's a funny way to use the word termination, because you send letters, you say it's going to terminate on February, whatever it was, 28th, 2007, and now we're really terminating it, now it's time to file your claims, and then all of a sudden you turn around and pull the rug out from under these people and say, oh, we were just kidding all along, we've changed our mind.
Well, I don't think they would say they were kidding, but you're correct, Your Honor, that the company did change its mind. And the process, again,
the question is, was it too late in the day, basically, to do that?
I understand. Now, with respect to the PBGC's position from a statutory standpoint, to which this court would ordinarily defer under both our and Chevron deference, the PBGC's view is that Finkel had an absolute right to withdraw that termination at any time. In fact,
what's the final outer limit of that right to withdraw? There must be something.
Well, I think the court will search in vain for it. I searched in vain for it, Your Honor. But the PBGC's brief says that all of the benefits have to be fully discharged. And by fully discharged, in the process of a standard termination, what is involved is the every participant has to be paid their full benefit. If they're entitled to a lump sum, as some individuals could elect a lump sum, they must be paid the full and accurate amount of their lump sum.
Well, the PBGC says, I mean, that there is an outer limit and that it's ascertainable because of two things, really. Not later than 30 days after all plan benefits are distributed, you give all participants a notice of annuity contract, if that's how they're getting their benefits, and no later than 30 days, again, after all plan benefits are distributed, you file a post-distribution certification, PBGC Form 501. Now, I assume no such Form 501 was ever filed in your case.
And Your Honor, just to kind of walk through the process, and I think Your Honor accurately described this earlier as a process, the trust assets must be used in the case of participants who have the right to receive annuities, must be used to pay for annuities.
So you go out in the market and you buy annuities, right?
And that, Your Honor, leads to a degree of uncertainty on the part of the plan sponsor who ordinarily will have to supplement the assets in the trust to purchase those annuities, because the cost of those annuities depends on what the interest rates are at the time, the applicable interest rates, and they can vary. So oftentimes the employer doesn't know what the expense is going to be until the individuals make their elections for what type of benefits they choose to receive, and then they go and price it. Now, in this case, the record is clear that the only thing that happened, the latest process, was individuals indicated what their elections would be if the plan terminated. But there were no annuities purchased, and no one received those final benefits. So clearly, there was no plan termination. And with respect to the other aspects of plan termination, once the plan terminates, the Finkel that has no further responsibilities with respect to that plan. Well, even the PBGC, I'm sorry.
Presumably it's an economic decision not to terminate.
Yes, Your Honor.
And I know they're saying, well, there was plenty of money or something they could have. But as I understand it, when several said they wanted to continue working and to receive the benefits, this upset the whole plan. And I don't know what the ramifications of that would have been, but that's when they called off the merger and said, I'm not going to terminate the plan. Now, what was the economic reason for that?
The record shows in Mr. Denton's declaration, Your Honor, that the costs of plan termination were higher than had been anticipated. That's what Mr. Denton's declaration states.
And is that a good enough reason just to call it off?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And if you look at the Beck v. Pace decision, the Supreme Court has said that this is a settlor function, that the employer can decide. There's no fiduciary aspects involved in that at all. The employer can decide not to terminate the plan for a good reason, a bad reason, or no reason at all.
And the PBGC or IRS, that's not a deciding factor, but that's just something that is sort of a gloss over. It's not really an endorsement one way or the other?
No, I think if Your Honor is asking whether this court should defer to the views of the PBGC, I think, in fact, this court does generally and has recognized that it should defer to the PBGC, who has that area of specialty. With respect to the question of whether or not the plan has terminated, and with respect to the Internal Revenue Service, the Supreme Court has recognized that the Internal Revenue Service has the initial responsibility in interpreting the anti-cutback provisions. That was decided in the Hines case. Now, I don't think the court even has to reach the anti-cutback issues because I think, as the court indicated in its first question, the district court correctly interpreted the plan and found that the committee's interpretation of the plan was not arbitrary and capricious in deciding that termination, actual termination under Title IV, was a precondition to any of these distributions. And when one reads the language of the of that decision, and the decision of the and the discussion by the committee is in the record. It's in the appeal denial of the plaintiff's appeal dated March 26, 2009, and the committee interprets Exhibit A, which is Amendment 1, as applying only in the event of the proposed termination of the pension plan. And I'm reading from the Part 1 of the appendix, separate from appellant's brief, at Appendix F. And it is a an exhibit to the answer of Finkel. And the court goes on to point out that all of the participants were advised at the outset in the notice of intent to terminate that the pension plan informed participants that termination might not occur and that if the proposed termination does not occur, we will notify you in writing.
Right, but then they do issue other notifications that certainly sound like companies going forward.
There's no question, Your Honor, that they did proceed with an intent. They continued that intent to terminate.
Apparently misled, right, you know, intentionally or otherwise, these people. I want to ask you before your time is up, the district court says I'm not really governed by this, but the tax consequences if this distribution were made without termination are something that I'm thinking about, or at least, you know, maybe it's a policy reason. Could you review what those tax consequences are?
Well, the Section 401 of the Internal Revenue Code provides certain requirements that a pension plan must meet. And one of those is that individuals, as a general rule, and there are a few exceptions to this, but as a general rule, in the case of defined benefit pension plans, individuals do not receive distributions while they are active employees. Now, there are provisions for in-service distributions. They do not apply here.
But when you say their requirements, it was my understanding that they're requirements only in the sense that if you want the tax benefits that go along with running a pension plan,
precisely correct,
this is what you have to do. It's not like you've, you know, robbed a bank or something. You haven't violated some positive law by not doing that. You just don't get any tax benefits.
But that would apply to all the participants in the plan. In other words, if the plan were to be determined to not qualify with respect to those qualification requirements, all participants in the plan would be taxed today as if they had receive the money, which has been deferred for them. In other words, ordinarily we don't receive, we're not taxed on our pension benefits until we actually receive them. That's a general exception to the rules.
Does the record show how many participants are in this plan?
It does not, Your Honor. It simply recognizes that they're, that the existing plaintiffs are a small minority within that larger group.
Okay. Well, they're the ones that were in there for 30 years, I suppose.
Yeah, all of the plaintiffs are have served 30 years or more, so they would qualify upon retirement for a full pension. One of these individuals, Mr. Couric, actually did retire in 2009. He is presently receiving his benefit, but the others are still.
The problem was that they were going to terminate, et cetera, and then continue working, and that was, I guess, what upset
the problem is that the plan didn't terminate. Had the plan terminated, there would not have been a problem, a tax problem or a tax qualification problem with respect to their receipt of those benefits.
Well, what if someone, I guess one who did retire?
Yes.
He is
receiving his normal 30-year retirement benefit.
So they could retire after 30 years.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Any question here, regardless of whether
they are fully vested. This does not impact any of their issues at all, Your Honor.
They just wanted to keep working and have the distribution up front.
That's correct. If Your Honor may, there are a couple other issues in the appeal. I'll address them briefly. I think the court understands the issue with respect to the attorney's fees claim with respect to count two. I think Finkel really assumed when it sent out that notice that it did not need to act further or consider those claims moot. But when advised that they weren't mooted, that the plaintiffs wanted a formal decision, the committee got it out in fairly short order. I would also point out, as the court knows, that under the applicable section of 29 U.S.C. 1132, the award of attorney's fees is discretionary with the court. And I think the district court properly exercised discretion in denying that. There are three other claims that are lumped together in count three, dealing with special bonuses. The special bonus issue is, I think, very correctly described by the district court. The company's contemporary records clearly distinguished at the time between a special bonus and a regular bonus, and those were faithfully followed. Those records are in the record. They are a little confusing to read because the lists on some of those involve many other individuals who aren't involved in this, so we redacted their names. But I think the records clearly showed a label of special and regular bonus.
The regular bonus one everybody gets?
Yes, in general.
Percentage of their salary or something.
Something like that. And I think it depended on a year-by-year basis. And since we're dealing with 30-year employees, some of these bonuses go back 20 years or more. And the history is that it used to be that no bonuses were included in these calculations. And then the company said, well, you know, let's include some, but if there's something special or unique or different or odd, we shouldn't be including that in the pension calculations. And those determinations were made, as I say, some in 1990, 91, 92, years before this litigation ever came up. And then finally, with respect to the last two points, the Miles and McFaughn claims, these were issues that were never brought forward as formal claims. Instead, they were legitimate points that individuals brought up that once the plan administrator learned of them, they corrected them. But they were never part of the claims procedure that we've referred to here. And the court properly ruled that because there had been a failure to exhaust, they weren't appropriate. And just summing up, I think the district court's decision is comprehensive and correct, and I urge you affirm in all respects. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. think you had a minute, Mr. Jaros. So,
thank you, Your Honor. I wish to direct the Court's attention to Appendix A69 of the PBGC's amicus brief. That is this regulation, 29 CFR 4041.28, and specifically subsection A. This is the core of the case. Finkel is in continuing violation of its duty under this regulation. Once the PBGC did not disapprove of the application that they filed for standard termination within the 180-day period, distribution is mandated. They are not allowed to change their mind except under subsection B, assets insufficient to satisfy plan benefits. Assets were not insufficient. The receivable from the company, whatever it might turn out to be, unless there was proof that the company could not full fund, there's not an insufficiency. There's no PBGC liability, no taxpayer liability. What Finkel did is to violate this regulation so that it could then argue, oh, we're allowed to take away the in-service benefit that we conferred. I urge the Court to carefully consider that regulation. Secondly, the PBGC footnote that we're relying on.
Okay, we know the footnote. Maybe you can just sum up. I remember the opinion.
Okay. Your Honor, with respect to the determination or whatever the committee decided, the district court summary judgment ruling quotes it on page 6, where the company says that it has withdrawn its termination of the pension plan. How can you withdraw something that has never occurred? Their whole argument is that the plan never terminated. It's contradicted by their own words that it did terminate, but now we're going back and withdrawing it. And that's where the rub is, because once it's terminated, then the in-service benefit becomes an entitlement, and now to take it away violates the cutback rules. So I think that the district court failed to properly seize on what the committee actually said. That's at page 6 of the summary judgment ruling.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Judge. Thank you, Your Honors.
The case will be taken under advisement. Thank